Today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1 with Allcare Pharmacy. Discover a healthcare team that's always here for you at Allcare Pharmacy, Ireland's largest community pharmacy network.
Email todaycb@rte.ie.
Almost 25 years on from the Good Friday Agreement, the importance of women's involvement in the peace process is being re-examined at this point. Liz O'Donnell was a junior minister for foreign affairs at the time of the negotiations representing the Irish government. Along with the Northern Ireland Women's Coalition, she was one of the few women involved directly in the talks leading up to the agreement, and she's with me here in the studio. Liz, you're very welcome.
Thanks, Claire.
Good to have you here. One of the pivotal figures, of course, during that time was the Northern Ireland Secretary Mo Molam. And Monica McWilliam said, I think controversially, that Mo was remembered more for bad language than her contribution to the peace process. And Monica felt that that was very unfair. Do you agree with that, or is that changing?
Well, I hope it changes, because she made a really significant contribution to the peace process and the negotiations. Because, well, her personality was unusual in that she was very, she was a classic Labour woman politician, very reforming by nature, and quite radical. And, you know, she approached everybody with a great degree of warmth and familiarity, which was quite a surprise to, say, the NIO, the people in Northern Ireland who were running the show, and also the politicians around the table, because but she was a highly intelligent woman and had absorbed a lot of the detail of the negotiations and the peace process when she was in opposition. Mm-hmm. So she had met many of the players before she was actually Secretary of State for Northern Ireland. So when she came into the negotiations, her manner was quite surprising because she was very irreverent. And of course, then later on in the negotiations, when she was quite unwell, you know, she would pull off her wig in the middle of a kind of a meeting, and, you know, she was, I think she was kind of she was disarming to some of the more traditional parties in the talks. But I loved her, and I felt that she was there at the right time. She was very important in building confidence amongst the nationalist negotiators. She was very supportive of the Women's Coalition as well. And she was very supportive of me as another female politician.
Sort of coalition in the talks amongst women, because there were so few of you?
Yes. Well, I mean, I came from the women's movement originally, and so did Monica McWilliams, and so did Mo. So you bring that baggage with you, and that armour, I suppose, as a woman into serious political negotiations. And as Monica always says, you know, people thought that they had fallen from the sky, the Women's Coalition. They've been involved in civic society, the women's movement, the peace movement, the trade union movement for 20 years. So they were actually veterans of the peace process. It's just that they got the formal opportunity to join the negotiations when the elections were held for the multi-party talks. Mm. Mo, similarly, I think we do bring, it's a female perspective. It's not better than anyone else's perspective, but it's different. And women bring a different perspective, life experience to the negotiations. And I found in particular that women in the negotiations across the board were more focused on finding solutions and overcoming obstacles rather than sitting in fixed positions. And George Mitchell very much encouraged us to shift from those fixed positions, because if you have everyone staying in their fixed position, mm-hmm. that they've traditionally held and articulated, you're not going to get anywhere. You're going to get standstill.
And how would you assess how the women were treated by the men who were there, in the majority, of course, the men?
Yeah. Well, in the talks from 97, I think I avoided the most of it because I was representing a government, a sovereign government, as a minister. So I think I avoided the most of it. God knows what they said behind my back, but I don't think so. I think they accepted me as representing the Irish government, and I was treated with civility. The women, on the other hand, who had come from outside the political theatre, you know, like the Women's Coalition, they had come from across civil society, and they had difficulty in convincing, I suppose, or being perceived as proper politicians. So they did undergo a lot of misogyny and, you know, insulting behaviour and disrespectful behaviour from the unionist politicians, particularly before in the period before the 97 talks started.
And how did George Mitchell deal with that?
George actually introduced civility to all of us, because it's wrong to think that it was only misogynistic abuse. What had passed for politics in Northern Ireland was very much name calling and shouting at people and not listening to the other party. So what George allowed us all to do was to talk without interruption. And then he would call out any bad manners or, you know, disrespect being shown to any member of the delegation. Mm-hmm. So I think he brought that dignity to the discussions, which was sadly lacking before. And his experience, of course, as a majority leader of the Senate, and his judicial background also gave him the authority to put manners on people.
What was it like for you being dropped into that scenario as junior minister at that point? I mean, it must have been extraordinary. And how did you read yourself into it and get yourself to a place where you needed to be?
Well, I remember being in I was only 5 years as a TD, and this was my first ministerial appointment. And we'd had a pretty hairy election. We'd gone from 10 deputies down to 4. So it wasn't a happy time for the Progressive Democrats. But in the course of, I was sitting in my Ivy House office, I had been designated Minister for Overseas Development and Human Rights, which I was delighted with. It was really an area of interest to me. But there was no ceasefire at the time. So the negotiations had floundered because of the Canary Wharf bomb. And on the 20th of July, there was a ceasefire. So technically, we were back in business in terms of negotiations. So Mary Harney rang me in my office in Ivy House, and apropos, and in relation to other matters, party matters we were talking, she said, "Oh, and by the way, you're doing the North." Of course, I nearly died of heart attack because... by the way, you're doing the North. So I said, OK, I was daunting because I was such a young deputy, you know, in terms of relative political experience. But I just said, listen, I knew I was going to be in the company of experienced politicians like Bertie and David Andrews as my senior minister. So anyway, I just got stuck in, did my homework. A lot of people don't realise that this process, the peace process, has been going since, you know, the late 80s, early 90s.
Yeah.
So there are a lot of the discussion documents, the framework document, the Downing Street Declaration, through the Albert Reynolds regime, through John Bruton, so the Rainbow Government, a lot of the kind of position papers had already been tabled. So we had a broad outline of where a possible settlement would lie. So I went off to Donegal anyway. It was the summer. There were no talks until September. So I had August to actually read all the stuff. And I did that.
I was full immersion.
Full immersion, because I had to. I mean, lives were at stake. I mean, loose words could cost lives. You know, people were still being murdered, and the ceasefires has only been reinstated, and it had been breached before. And we knew we had to be very careful with language. Mm-hmm. And, you know, trust was in short supply. And when we sat down in September, I did feel, I felt ready, because I knew I was up to speed. I was fully briefed and I was happy enough to go into the negotiations. But of course, the minute Sinn Féin came into the negotiations, the DUP walked out. So immediately we had a problem, because that important cohort of unionist opinion was outside the talks, mm-hmm. which was a source of regret immediately to me, because it meant that David Trimble of the Ulster Unionist Party was on his own, essentially, representing unionism. So the fact that he was constantly being vilified from outside the talks by the DUP, called a traitor, all the rest of it, it meant that he moved very slowly and with great hesitation to do anything, because politically he was very exposed. Mm.
Did you recognise that at the time? Because I think in the years since then, people have looked at the political and personal sacrifice that David Trimble made, and we know that he was given the award with John Hume and so on. So there was recognition of it, I suppose, at the time. But the significance of what he did at that time, it's huge, isn't it, when you look back?
It's huge. He really had to kind of take a leap of faith based, you know, because there wasn't, you know, so much wasn't tied down at the end. We didn't have clear commitment on decommissioning. You know, the whole policing thing had to be parked. You know, the demilitarisation, the whole reworking of Northern Ireland and how it was going to be governed. You know, the scale of the breadth of change envisaged by the agreement was huge. But I think we did place a huge amount of importance on keeping David in, because if David walked out, we didn't have a peace process. We didn't have a settlement. Mm-hmm. And similarly, I would give credit to the loyalist parties, David Irvine and his colleagues, for staying in with David, because it gave him a little bit of ballast in that loyalist communities were represented and mainstream unionism was represented in the negotiations.
It was clearly a very intense experience. You've explained to us how high the stakes were, one word out of line and you were in a very difficult place. When you go through the intensity of that experience with people, do you make friends with them?
Well, we got to know each other. I think relationships were extremely important. And I was surprised when I joined the talks they didn't really know each other very well, because I think by keeping apart and barking at each other, from their respective positions, had passed for politics. So having people in an intense negotiation situation and stuck in castle buildings for all that length of time, months over months, people got to know each other and people began to listen to the position of the other side, mm-hmm. put themselves in the shoes of the other side. And we were hoping that the unionists would start to understand the grievance, which was at the heart of the troubles, the grievance of the nationalist community.
And how, I don't know if you can answer this, but who was the most difficult personality to deal with at that time?
I think David was, because he was under so much pressure. Now, Geoffrey Donaldson walked out the morning of the talks. So that's what we were dealing with. You know, there was divided councils within the unionist party represented at the talks. Mm. So not only did he have the DUP outside threatening all sorts of activity and opposition, but within his own party, he didn't have a united party. So I think his position was completely understandable. His kind of aggressive manner and, diffident manner and refusing to shake people's hands, all of that was symptom of the difficulty that he was in, and I suppose the fear and the leap of faith he had to take to actually agree to the agreement.
And the toll it must have taken on every person who was involved in those talks over that period of time, again going back to the intensity of and what you were trying to achieve, it must have been a difficult time personally for everybody.
It was and exhausting. I was up there 3 days a week from September to Easter. And, there were most of the meetings weren't held in that big room, the big plenary session. It was mostly bilateral meetings, like we would meet the unionists or we'd meet Sinn Féin or we'd meet the SDLP. There were very few round table talks. They were just set pieces to reassure the public outside that we were actually sitting there. Mm-hmm. But a lot of the negotiations and the chair's secretariat was brilliant. Martha Pope talking to everybody, encouraging everybody. The Women's Coalition were very good conduits as well, and they were good readers of sentiment in the community. So they were very helpful to the government and with the other parties.
And looking at the situation now, we do not have the institutions up and running. We don't have much hope that we're going to see that happening anytime soon. So how do you assess the success of the Good Friday Agreement based on that?
Well, on the first thing, I do have hope that we will get the institutions up and running. I think it's a source of regret that the institutions, the assembly and the executive, the power sharing arrangements that had been envisaged have only sat fitfully. But when they sat, they did work. I think they've been subjected to the kind of the conundrums that have happened. Brexit has completely disrupted everything, not least in the United Kingdom, the relationship between the United Kingdom and the European Union and Ireland. But also it meant that the two parties of government in Northern Ireland went in different directions, mm-hmm. Which, was a complete disaster for any hope of power sharing. So really what we're dealing with now in terms of the Windsor framework is a continuum of the efforts by the EU and the two governments to actually, deal with the post-Brexit trade conundrum. Because, no matter what way you look at it, since you have a Brexit, you accept you have a Brexit, the UK has left, you have to have some sort of, it raises jurisdictional issues. You have to have a border somewhere. but we couldn't have a border because of the agreement. So I think the two governments have worked really hard to overcome these obstacles. And now there's a softening of language. And I think the unionist position has been ameliorated. You know, their opposition to the protocol has been ameliorated. It's now up to Geoffrey Donaldson and his colleagues. I don't think they should be pressurised. I think they have to be happy to go in, because if they go in and they're not quite happy, it won't be enduring.
Yes,
so we need those institutions to
again.
Yeah, we need the institutions to stay and be enduring.
Liz, thank you very much for coming
You're
in.
Welcome,
That's
Claire.
Liz O'Donnell. We'll have Nevin and Brian with us after the break with some fresh spring recipes. That's after this.
Text 51551 today with Claire Byrne on RTE Radio 1.